This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 12th day of February 2011 here in Japan, and it is still the 11th day of February 2011 in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by Alex Abeya, a New York Times notable book author, Emmy-nominated TV reporter, and screenwriter. Alex Abeya is the author of Soldiers of Reason, The Rand Corporation, and The American Empire, a study of the world's most influential think tank, published by Harcourt. Alex was the first journalist to have full access to Rand's files in Santa Monica, California, and his website is available at alexabeya.com. That's Alex, A-B-E-L-L-A, all one word, .com. Alex Abeya, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you here, especially to talk about this, which is an extremely important topic, the Rand Corporation and the way that it has shaped our world and the world around us for the past half a century. And it is such a mind-bogglingly large topic for most people who don't really know Rand other than as some sort of vaguely defined think tank. So in order to start getting into this, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the origins of Rand and what was really the impetus behind the creation of this nonprofit corporation.
Well, Rand actually became sort of like the prototype for a military defense-aligned think tank. It came out as an offshoot of the Air Force. The way that it happened is that there was a general in the Air Force, this is back when the Army and the Air Force were one, before they split up. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to replicate the success of the Manhattan Project, you know, as you know, that developed the atomic bomb. Because after the war was over, scientists, you know, were going to go back to their labs, and businessmen just wanted to make money, and the army was going back to its barracks. But this guy said, now hold on a minute here. We still have a world that's full of dangers, and we need somebody to come up with new and better weapons. So basically, Rand then was developed as a civilian prototype of the Manhattan Project that would create bigger and better weapons of mass destruction. So it became then an adjunct of the Air Force, and it was sited at an airplane manufacturing plant, a Douglas aircraft here in the West Coast in California, because the general was related by marriage to the owner of Douglas aircraft. But after a couple of years, what happened is that Rand just grew to be too big, and they were getting more and more contracts, and Douglas ultimately said, you know, you guys can't stay anymore because this is affecting our business, because it looked as though it was a conflict of interest between the Air Force and Douglas. So Rand then was spun off as a separate corporation, and a corporation that at that point was advised by the man who would become the head of the Ford Foundation and the first president of the Ford Foundation. So there was always a close connection between the two organizations. Then it became, even though it was still nominally independent, it was still giving a lot of advice to the Pentagon, specifically on, you know, weapons of mass destruction. They were concerned about developing the intercontinental ballistic missile. One of his first projects, one of his first plans, was for an orbiting space station. And they were the ones to show scientifically how such a thing could be achieved, which before had only been in the province of, you know, science fiction writers and comic book writers, illustrators. And they said, no, this can be done, and we should do it. Said, you know, they predated Sputnik, it predated NASA and all that. So it was from the beginning, they were set up as visionaries, but visionaries trying to advance the cause of American interests, and obviously to create better and bigger weapons of mass destruction. And then after a while, they realized that they really didn't know that much about the most important element of all weaponry, which is the human factor. And then they started branching then into social sciences, and ultimately their influence in politics grew and grew to the point that they, in 1960, when President Kennedy was took over, he basically recruited them all to come in and redo the Pentagon, and along the way, they also redid, you know, the way that the entire federal government was run. And not only that, I think they also changed all the philosophical foundations of Western civilization, which I know sounds kind of grandiloquent, but it's actually quite true. In my book, Soldiers of Reason, I say that we, in a way, are all the bastard children of Rand, and we don't even know it. They came up with something called rational choice theory, which was, in response to communism. And that has completely altered the way that we look at government and the way that we look at the world.
That's right, and I do want to get into that, but let's just back up a moment, because you mentioned the Kennedy administration as being a sort of key turning point in bringing these people into the Pentagon, and I don't know actually the specific history of McNamara and whether he was at all related to Rand, but certainly he's been described as a human computer and that sort of thing, and certainly seems to fit in with the Rand way of analyzing problems. Was McNamara actually involved with Rand?
Yes, well, they shared the same ethos, so to speak. As you know, McNamara was like the youngest president of any major corporation in the United States at the time. I think he was only 40 when he was recruited. He and his fellow technocrats were recruited to take over the Ford Corporation, they did a great job of it. And then he was recruited in turn to head the Pentagon. He was never directly hired or worked for Rand, but he did recruit people from Rand to redo the Pentagon because they both believed in the primacy of numbers. If you've read about Vietnam, or even if you're old enough to remember something called I think it was called the Friday Night Follies, in which all of a sudden they would put down like the number of people of Viet Cong that had been killed as evidence that the war was being won. This constant emphasis on the quantitative aspects of life instead of the qualitative aspects of life. And that was very much a mind frame that was shared by both the Rand people and McNamara. And to some degree, I mean, just today I was looking at the Rand organization, at the Rand Corporation and their website, and they're still talking about, weather modeling, which is one of the things that they came up with, whether they should include qualitative factors, i.e. soft factors, and I'm quoting here, despite critics who think that doing so reduces rigor. In other words, they still, it's really funny, 50 years later, they still don't get it. That was the problem. That's one of the reasons why we lost in Vietnam, because we never really took into account the soft factors, so to speak. But in any case, Rand, it developed something called a number of things, developed many, many things. But the two main contributions were something called systems analysis, which is a way of discovering the solution to problems by focusing on what your wanted result is instead of what your available tools are. Because usually the way that things have been decided, especially the government, is like these are our assets, and how much can we get out of them? Rand turned that around and put it on its head and said, no, what we want is to get here to point X. In order to get to point X, what is it that we have to do in order to achieve that particular purpose, which is something that had never been done in government. So that's one thing that they came up with. And the other thing that they came up with was, as I said before, rational choice theory, in which posits that, we're all selfish human beings and there's no such thing as religion, altruism, or patriotism, which, of course, is completely antithetical to everything that the Viet Cong and many patriotic Americans believe in, but that's what they believed in at the time. And as a result of that, that theory became then the foundation for the financial deregulation of markets and for the repeal of many of the regulations that had kept Wall Street and banks in check, ultimately resulting in the Glass-Steagall Act, the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, and, to the financial mess that we find ourselves in today.
So really, I mean, it's an incredibly wide range of things that Rand has impacted on, from not only military, but also, I mean, every aspect of our lives, really.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, if you believe that everybody is self-centered, there is no such thing as altruism, then therefore there's no such thing as patriotism, obviously, because politicians, and some people will perhaps agree with this, but I'm kind of old-fashioned, and I think that not everybody's like this, then you will think that all politicians are only empowered to enrich themselves, all for self-glorification, and that nobody is there really to do what's best for the people. So therefore, that's only a very small step from there to Ronald Reagan's famous, the government is the problem. Which is funny because considering then he ran for president, he wanted to be in charge of the problem, which is he would be responsible for the problem. Be that as it may, that's getting a little bit too complicated even for me. But the point being that if you don't believe that there is anything, that there is any kind of non-selfish drive in human beings, then what happens is that all your view of civilization, of your daily life, is altered. Therefore, you are no longer a citizen with rights and responsibilities, but you're only a consumer with choices. Choices, by the way, that you yourself don't make, that are just given to you. You become then a passive receptor of all these things that are force-fed into you by corporations. In a way, I can't blame the people who came up with this. And by the way, there was a Nobel Prize-winning economist named Kenneth Arrow, because in a way, they were trying to react to the danger posed by communism. Most people alive today are not aware that at the end of the World War II, I mean, a lot of people in the intelligentsia really thought that Western democracies were doomed, and that our way of living was not going to last, and that the way for the future did belong to the communist and the socialist bloc. Of course, they were totally mistaken, obviously. But that's the way that people thought, so they had to come up with something that would justify philosophically, and especially from a rigorous mathematical point of view, which is the way that Rand looked at things, our existence and our very way of being. So therefore, you know, it was no longer then the Harvard School of Government became Harvard School of Policy, then became policies, because each different party is pushing its own agenda, because nobody's thinking of everybody as a whole. All as a result of this one particular theorem that was developed by Mr. Arrow at Rand. And Rand was like the center of that particular line of thought, and it's influenced each and every single Nobel Prize for economics that has been awarded in the last 40 years. They've all taken as a foundation, as its base, that we are homus economicus, that we are all selfish creatures, and that therefore we have to react accordingly, and that the only thing that we react to are financial stimuli, which is, I think, not quite true.
Well, you raise a very intriguing and important point there, because if it all does boil down to us as individuals defined as consumers, just given a bunch of choices, and those choices being predefined and pre-limited for us so that society can be shaped in a certain direction, then what does that say about the Rand Corporation itself, which is really on the surface only presenting case studies or looking into certain possibilities, but simply by looking into certain possibilities, aren't they in a way shaping the course of society?
Not only that, my friend, you first have to remember that he who frames the argument has already won half of it. If you shape the question, you can, to a very large degree, influence the answer, because it will be the answer to the question that you pose. So therefore, just by making a particular deliberate choice of the arguments that are to be taken into consideration, you're already framing the answer, A. But B, it goes beyond that, because, for instance, that's what the Brookings Institution does. Brookings Institution is another think tank that was founded in the 1920s that never did have as much influence as Rand, and it's only been now under the Obama administration that they finally found their own voice, and a lot of the people have gone into the Obama administration, whereas for decades before it was Rand, you know, like Donald Rumsfeld going from the Rand Board of Trustees to head the Pentagon. But be that as it may, one of Rand's tenets is that they not only frame the question and tell you what is the right question to ask of any one particular problem. And many Rand scientists and researcher and executive has come up to me and, you know, stated quite proudly that, you know, they are notorious for that, that a client may come to them with a particular problem and they say, well, this is what we want the answer to. And they would say, no, you're looking at the wrong set of facts. This is the question that you should ask, and this is the answer that you should hear. Be that as it may, not only do they do that, they also then go out of the way to make sure that the policymakers in the U.S. government get that information. And that is the crux of the matter and the heart of their responsibility. A responsibility which today, to this date, they deny any part of. What do I mean by that? I mean that for instance, let us look at Vietnam, in which they came up with something called the Viet Dong study, in which they they saw how the Viet Cong in reality were not driven by selfish motives, but actually were idealistic actors who really wanted to wanted the best for the family and for the country. They submitted that, but then when it was denied, when the Johnson administration decided not to pay attention to it, then they turned around and then just started feeding other arguments such as, well, bombing the Viet Cong then would actually be good because then that, even if it kills the villagers, then the villagers will not turn against the U.S., but will turn against the Viet Cong for having provoked the bombing that wiped their villages. That kind of contorted Byzantine logic that was exactly what the administration wanted to hear. My point being is that they come up with, they frame the question, they give you an answer that perhaps you hadn't even thought of, and then they make sure that the people who can implement that particular policy listen to it and put it into effect. So that's what makes them doubly responsible. Not only that, what you have to also bear in mind is that RAND is the birthplace of what today is called the military-industrial complex. It comes out directly out of people in RAND and affiliated with RAND in the late 1950s.
Well, from what I understand, it was people affiliated with RAND who were feeding information to the Kennedy administration, or the incumbent Kennedy administration at the time, about a possible missile gap with the Soviets that Kennedy used to campaign to get into power.
That's correct. And there was a missile gap that never existed. And that was a deliberate choice on their part. But they also came up with a report before called the Gator Report, again, you know, after Gator, who was the first president of the Ford Foundation, who had been the legal advisor to RAND when it incorporated. And in which report, it advised the Eisenhower administration that we were falling behind the Soviet Union in terms of armaments and nuclear capabilities, and that the Soviet Union still exhibited an uncontrollable desire to basically take over the world. And, you know, and they argued for increasing the Pentagon budget. And Eisenhower looked at it, and he said, no, I'm not going to do this, because one of the things that it advocated is, you know, nuclear preparedness, saying we can survive a nuclear war. And, of course, one of the major figures that got around at that time, a scientist named Herman Kahn, was going around the country, you know, giving lectures, saying that, you know, even if only a third of the population survives, that we will have won. We'll come out of our tunnels, we'll come out of our caves, and if we have defeated the enemy, we will have won. Which, of course, is a hollow victory. And Eisenhower said himself, you know, there won't be enough shovels to be able to bury all the dead. So Eisenhower wanted to, A, bring down the Pentagon budget, and B, reach some kind of compromise with the Soviets. But these people just raised the alarms all the time. And they released this secret report. They released it to the media, and they really gave all this false information to Kennedy, knowing full well that it was false, or at least tendentious, because they wanted that Pentagon budget to be increased so they will profit. RAND would profit because they would get more contracts, and all the people who were on the RAND board would profit because all the industries would profit with the increase in Pentagon spending. It's terrible, but that's the way it was.
So Eisenhower warned about it in his farewell address, and when Kennedy found out that the missile gap was not true, apparently there were a number of four-letter expletives that he uttered to his aide. So, yeah, well, it is so mind-boggling to think that such bald-faced lies and manipulation would go on. But I suppose it's not surprising once you really study what's going on at this level. But bringing it to more recent times, how about the war in Iraq or the Project for a New American Century or other things that have shaped our more recent political times?
Right, correct. Well, the Project for the New American Century, yes. Mr. Paul Wolfowitz, whom I think your listeners probably remember, Secretary of Defense with Mr. Rumsfeld. Wolfowitz himself was affiliated with RAND, and he was a protege of perhaps the most influential person to come out of RAND, whom I describe in my book, Soldiers of Reason, a man named Albert Wallstetter. Albert Wallstetter, who originally himself, he's like considered the father of neoconservatism, and who had been a Trotskyite, that is, he had been a communist when he was younger, but then, you know, changed his mind and said, no, I think that I'll go the other way, and whose wife was a brilliant, brilliant historian, especially on Pearl Harbor, Wolfowitz was a protege of Albert Wallstetter, and he came up with, you know, with this concept that, the United States had to be in constant battle with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was constantly stretching its tentacles all over the place, and that we had to preserve our rights as they saw them, and our privileges, so to speak, and advocated basically just going in and taking out Saddam Hussein. And that's ultimately, that's what we did, didn't we?
Absolutely, and it's once again goes back to, Rand and the, minions that come out of there. So very, very revealing. And I have no doubt that Rand will continue to be infested at the very heart of the, military industrial complex, which is only growing and gaining. And it almost seems like instead of a military industrial complex, it's becoming a military information complex. And some of the ramifications of that are even more horrifying, really.
That is correct. And they were the first, one of the first to actually point out the concept, to come up with the concept of net wars, in which wars will be cyber wars. You know, all the attacks that, for instance, we're having right now in the Pentagon. What is it? They get like 10,000 attacks a day, and the way in which, you know, terrorist cells can organize themselves. They've been in the thick of that since the very beginning. Matter of fact, Rand was one of the first to establish a data bank on terrorist attacks. And you might even say that the very concept of terrorist studies comes out of Rand as well. They've been involved in so many, their fingers are the thumbs and their whole hand. They are in so many pies that it's really, it's just stunning when you stop and think about what they have done and all the things that they and their people have been involved in. Just to give you another example, just Daniel Ellsberg, as you know, with the Pentagon Papers. Those of you who remember, you know, the Vietnam War, again, you know, the Pentagon Papers was a study that was commissioned by Robert McNamara to see what were the causes of the Vietnam War, and in which illustrated so vividly how the U.S. government had been lying time and time and time and time again to its own citizens and to the world at large, although not to governments, which is another thing that just came up with WikiLeaks with Mr. Julian Assange, which for which I'm so glad he of which I'm so glad he did. But be that as it may, so depending on papers, come out of one of those safe at the Rand Corporation in Santa Monica, and that's where Ellsberg took it out of. You know, so as to denounce what was going on in Vietnam. So they've been all over the place, and they continue to be. So even at today, I mean, over half of their budget still comes from the Pentagon, still comes from doing defense work.
Well, I suppose all of this leads to the question of how on earth did you manage to gain access to Rand's archives and live to tell the tale, so to speak?
Well, fortunately, we, at least at this point, we are not in a society where people are killed for exposing secrets like that. They're just discredited. They try to smear you and to say, well, you got your facts wrong, etc. Matter of fact, when I was interviewed in a local radio program here in California, NPR, about a week later, the vice president of Rand, who had cooperated in this whole thing, came on the program upset that they had actually put me on the program and wanted to refute what I had said. But obviously he couldn't because my facts were the facts. She just didn't like my interpretation of them. Be that as it may, you know, I'm still here, obviously I'm still talking to you. Now, why did they authorize it? That's a question. I presume it's because they thought that I would be whitewashing what they did. I just wanted to tell the facts straight as they were, and to pose some, you know, questions. And the question was, should an organization like this even be allowed to exist in a democracy?
Well, that is an extremely important question, and one that I think perhaps we already know the answer to, but at any rate, very, very interesting. And I certainly hope people will go and purchase Soldiers of Reason, the Rand Corporation, and the American Empire. So tell people how they can go about doing that.
Oh, certainly. Well, you can go to Amazon.com, you can go to my website, alexabella.com, alexabella.com, and, you know, you'll be directed to Amazon or any your favorite book buying place on the internet, and you can get it from there. And, you know, go to my website as well. I also have a newsletter that I put out regularly, and I'm on Facebook as well. And, you know, I've been blogging a little bit, and I've talked a little bit about about Egypt, which just happened today with Mubarak stepping down and the similarities and, you know, what that portends for the future, not only in the Arab world, but also in China and also in Cuba. As you know, I'm of Cuban origin, and I think that this kind of cyber connection that allowed the revolt in Egypt to actually succeed and depose Mubarak is the one thing that the Castro regime is deadly afraid of. You know, anybody who is afraid of freedom, who wants to keep control of their people, they always want to control the internet. And that's the one thing that we should never relinquish, because the moment we give that up, we basically have no other way of getting our voices heard, because all media can be controlled. So we have to keep it free.
That's absolutely right. You'll certainly have no argument from me here. And the Corbett Report wouldn't exist, and I wouldn't be talking to you without the internet. And we have to absolutely fight for that freedom, because it is absolutely essential to what we're doing right now. So once again, that's extremely important. So is that perhaps the basis for your next work?
No. I'm not working on that next. Next, actually, I'm working on. Well, I can't talk about it, but I hope that you know, people will read it, and you know, they'll find it interesting.
All right. Well, perhaps we can have you back on in the future. But at any rate,
that
Alex,
would be my pleasure.
Excellent. Well, Alex Abaya, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.